Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Doug Henwood, journalist, radio host, and author of multiple books, joins me to discuss the rot in this iteration of our ruling class and how we got to this point, a combination of greed, labor losses, wealth consolidation, and, of course, the modern Republican Party.
And Heather Digby Parton will help us break down all the top news items of the week. Hey, folks, don't forget you can support this show by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. And when you do, you not only support this show, you get extra content every week. This week, you'll hear my second interview I did with assistant professor of law at the University of Michigan, Leah Littman, as she recounts the last couple of rulings by the Supreme Court in this past session. And these were devastating rulings for A, our elections in terms of the right to vote and the Voting Rights Act, and B, transparency in our elections and who's giving what to whom in terms of money. Two very important and disturbing rulings that will have an impact on future rulings as well. You can check that out by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. ROFpodcast.com. Let me say it one more time. ROFpodcast.com. It's your support that keeps us on the air. So, Heather, we have a lot to talk about this week. Many different, sort of surprisingly so. We're waiting for the infrastructure bill stuff to start getting going in a bigger way, but it has started to move. We had Chuck Schumer with a procedural vote yesterday that didn't really go anywhere, with the idea that it's we're going to sort of negotiate and sort of go back to the drawing board, I guess, and maybe have this vote on Monday. This is the bipartisan bill, which, you know, really, I think you and I have always been skeptical as to whether there was actually 10 Republican votes for this. They claim that there is. However, it seems like every other day they drop a provision that all of a sudden becomes extremely offensive to them. The latest one this week was, as you know, the idea of the IRS actually doing a better job at their job. The IRS has been sort of systematically defunded over the course of the past decade or so. And it is, I mean, it is an amazing return on investment. For every dollar that you put into the IRS, you get about six back. And it also has a lot of implications in terms of a wealth equality, because right now, they don't have the resources to go after the big fish. And so they go after the little fish, who they know don't have the lawyers, and it's much easier to recoup the money. And they're going for the very, very low-hanging fruit. One of the big questions is to whether, if the bipartisan bill falls apart, which I think it's going to, will that money end up in the Democratic reconciliation bill? What's your sense of what's going on right now? It's a little bit tough to tell.
It really is tough to tell. And I think we're in the middle of this negotiation, and negotiations are always like this. People are taking public positions that are different than the ones they take privately, and vice versa. It's, you know, it's a very, fluid situation, I would say. I don't think this is in the bag. I don't think either one of these bills are in the bag, the reconciliation bill or this bipartisan bill. And I think, you know, that there seems to be a lot of confidence on the part of Democrats. Like, I saw John Tester on TV talking yesterday about, he seemed really confident that this bipartisan bill was going to pass. He said he thought it was a good idea that Schumer put this pressure on by forcing a vote this week. I don't really pretend to understand that. I don't know why that would make a difference, but apparently it did, according to John Tester anyway. So they are talking, though, that they're saying that they needed the pressure to keep working through the weekend. And then on Monday, I guess, unless there's another delay, they want to force the vote. Now, I understand why Schumer wants to pressure I'm not questioning the desire and the need to pressure, because one of the big games that Republicans always play on these things is to delay, delay, delay. The further out they go, the less popular it becomes, the more chance that the administration or the Democrats are going to run into trouble in some other way. So it's in their best interest to just keep delaying it and pretending like they are operating in good faith, which they most often are not. And I still suspect they are not, even now. So, you know, we'll see what happens with that. I mean, but as to your question, will they put that money, if the bipartisan bill fails, will they put that money into the reconciliation bill? You know, I don't know, but I have a strong feeling that that stuff is going to have to go, that the actual projects that they're talking about, the infrastructure things that they want to do with roads, bridges, broadband, you know, that where they're spending the money has to go in there. I mean, that is, you know, the ultimate definition of infrastructure. They have to do it. And that raises the price substantially on the reconciliation infrastructure bill, unless they decide that they have to toss all this, you know, other stuff overboard, which may very well
That is my fear that they will bring in. There was about $500-600 billion of new spending. There was about another $300 billion that I guess was in part recouped from money that was still left over from the COVID relief bill, is my understanding, to the extent that we have any sense of what's in that bill. And it would be concerning, because I agree with you. They're not going to do an infrastructure bill without doing like the hard infrastructure.
Right.
And most of that $500 billion, in fact, probably all of it, is hard infrastructure, you know, internet, trains, highways, bridges. And my fear would be that some of the stuff that you and I particularly like the so-called human infrastructure, that may be the stuff that they start to throw overboard if they get married to this $3.5 trillion number, which is sort of absurd. It's a completely random number. I mean, this is the thing, when you start to watch these things like this, you start to realize like the level of pettiness and just, I don't know, inertia. I mean, this is, you know, this is like, I don't even know. I'm trying to, you know, I mean, I can understand why Chuck Schumer does this, but it really is sort of almost like the same theory with, you know, a pickup softball game. Like, let's pick teams. Well, everybody's not here yet. Well, let's just pick teams. And, you know, when the other couple people come, that way we're ready to go. And I mean, that sort of feels like what it's like, because if you don't start picking the teams, then you got guys over here, you know, like, oh, I want some batting practice. Hey, let me warm up my arm. And then it's tough to get everybody again. And just the idea that the largest expenditure since the New Deal, and one that I think, you know, has some real structural elements to it, in terms of, not no pun intended, but in terms of, like, you know, our relationship with our government, the idea that, you know, you're going to have a more permanency to the child tax credit, you know, 5 years, it's tough to pull that back after 5 years, things like maybe increasing the benefits for Medicare, maybe dropping the Medicare eligibility age, although that looks a little bit less likely. But I could go on. There are other dynamic, the free community college and universal pre-K. I mean, these are, you know, structural changes to the way that Americans view their relationship with the government. And to think that it's coming down to this type of like stuff, I think sometimes, just even after, I don't know, 15, 20 years in doing this, I still am sort of shocked that this is the way that our lives are essentially, affected or not. And so I think, you know, what Schumer did makes sense. At the very least, there's a quality of saying to the Republicans, look, it is time to put up or shut up. And this process is starting. All I've done now is fired up the locomotive. And but that's an indication, you know, that toot toot with the train's about to leave the station. And so it's all aboard time, and either you're going to get aboard or not. And so I think that's good. And then it also, you know, put some pressure on people like Manchin and Sinema, who like, right. We went through the whole thing, the whole nine for you guys, and it didn't work out. I mean, this is the Sinema Portman bill. And so right. It's going to put a significant amount of pressure on her. There's some polling coming out in terms of like her, you know, Democratic primary, but it's going to put some significant pressure on her because her name's on this bill. And if it fails to get support from Republicans, she's going to be the person that people look at and go, hey, wait, what was going on here? You didn't do this very well. And it's going to, you know, for her to turn around and then try and sink the reconciliation bill, I think it might be a little bit difficult. And so, but we shall see what's going to be in it. I want to, you know, turn to the other thing that I found sort of fascinating, what's going on now. And we have this very strange dynamic that's happening right now in terms of like the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. There does not seem, we're not going to get any Republican votes probably for the bipartisan bill, so-called, and certainly not for the reconciliation. But there also doesn't seem to be much argument against any of this happening. They're just not going to vote for it, but they're not out politicking about it at all. I mean, their response to this $3.5 trillion bill is don't teach critical race theory to kindergarten students. Okay. There's another element that's going on here, right? We have two other things that are in play, like the 1-6 commission. And the coronavirus. And let's talk about that, because the Delta variant now is overwhelmingly the majority of infections that are happening in the country right now. It's about 83%, according to the CDC. This was to be expected, but it's been sort of stunning how quickly it's happened. I mean, I don't know if it was more than 4 weeks ago that we were saying like it's 20%. And so we're seeing that it causes breakthrough infections regardless of your vaccination status. It changes a little bit depending on that, but the vaccinations keep you out of the hospital, and they keep you out of, they keep you from dying almost. I mean, you know, we have in Alabama, they're talking about, you know, we have hundreds of people dying, and yet only one person in the hospital, you know, was vaccinated, and they just need a little bit of oxygen. They're fine. And then suddenly Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, it was as if someone flicked a switch and a certain segment of the establishment Republican Party and its, you know, media mouthpieces, at the very least, started talking positively about vaccinations. Not all of them, not Ingram and Carlson. And sure, you know, Hannity said, you should get vaccinated. I got vaccinated. My wife got vaccinated. Sandwiched in between two segments that were about vaccine skepticism. What is going on?
Well, you know, it's really interesting to see this happen. And obviously the Delta variant, the spread of this, which is, you know, it's much more virulent in terms of the contagious nature of it than the original or any of the other variants have been. I mean, clearly, as you said, just like 2 weeks ago, it was like, well, here's the Delta variant, 20% are there. Now suddenly it's all of them. So we know that. And we know that from other countries as well. I mean, and we can sort of see that coming. A lot of the epidemiologists were saying, hey, look, this thing really spreads. It's a spreader. So what's happening is that a lot of people are, you know, we're having this surge, which is very scary. But the surge is happening only among a certain you know, part of the population, at least the deadly and very sick part of the surge. There are people who are testing and go, wow, I've got it. I feel fine. Or I got a sniffles for a couple of days, you know, like a mild flu, and they got it even though they've been vaccinated. So it's, as you say, this is, as the administration saying, it's a pandemic surge of the unvaccinated. These are the people who are winding up in the hospital. Well, what I think happened, honestly, is that suddenly you go look at the maps of where this is happening, where it's really taking off among the unvaccinated, and it is predominantly in places where, you know, where there are a lot of Republican voters. And I think what happened was, and a lot of the sort of, you know, the never Trumper types who used to work in the business, like Rick Wilson or, you know, Stuart Stevens or whatever, they're all saying, look, they saw polling. There's no other explanation for this. They saw polling. Suddenly, it's like all these, I mean, you know, people have been dying for a long time. And it's like, you know, they had a propensity for saying things like, well, it's just old people. Well, it's just sick people. Well, it's just, you know, people with a high BMI or whatever, comorbidities. I mean, they were always making excuses. Well, now it's just people. And a lot of them are their own voters and their own constituents and people in their own families. I mean, there's guys like Steve Scalise, who, you know, and Bill Cassidy. Those guys they're from Louisiana. Scalise refused to get vaccinated until this week, which is like mind boggling to me, but yeah. There you go. And now he's out there saying, I got it. It's safe. It's wonderful. Good for him. I mean, I'm glad that they're doing this. I mean, thank God that they finally seen the light, however cynically it has had to come to them. But I don't believe it's because suddenly they just read an article in the New England Journal of Medicine and realized that the vaccines were safe. Nothing's changed other than the fact that their own voters are getting this. And suddenly they're realizing that maybe killing your own voters is not a good political strategy, which right. it's always been bizarre to me that they did this. So I think that's where we're at. And, you know, I'm glad of it. And it may also be, you know, like in the media, when you see, especially Fox News, if you see this came through the news section, the sort of the daytime talkers, and Hannity's been sort of playing both sides on this from the beginning. I mean, this isn't the first time that he said, go get, you know, vaccines are safe, but something came down, I think, on high at Fox, and whether that came from polling or whether it just came from a sudden awareness from. It could be from Rupert Murdoch himself, for all I know, because, you know, he's looking at Australia, where he's right. from. I think James, yeah. or is it Lachlan, whoever's the one that's in charge now. I don't remember. He's in Australia. And I think they're seeing that happen there, which is really shocking. And they didn't have the vaccines the way that we did. You're watching what's happening in Japan with the Olympics. And they also, both of those countries did very well in the first phase. They did all the right things. They mitigated, but this Delta variant is getting them now. And they don't have the high levels of vaccination. So I think that that's probably where it's coming from, way, way, way overdue. But if it works and they are able to persuade people, and there is, you know, the polling is just so depressing on this. I mean, there is a large subgroup of Republicans who just will never, ever get the vaccines. And I don't know what you do about people like that. I just don't know. They're unpersuadable. They can't, no matter who it is, Donald Trump could come to their house and say, you know, I will personally put you up at Mar-a-Lago if you get this, and you'll be part of my next administration. They still won't do it. I mean, I don't know why that is, but they're just ornery people, I guess.
There was a heartbreaking, I mean, it was reported on pretty widely. This is from Alabama.com, and I think it got picked up nationally as well. A doctor who works at the Grandview Medical Center in Birmingham, Alabama, got on Facebook and was just basically I don't even know what to call it. It's not quite venting. I mean, it's just sort of relieving herself of just sort of the pain that she, you know, experienced by, she's got a lot of patients who are sitting there saying, you know, give me the vaccine now. And she's like, it's too late, as they are dying. And she, you know, it's, I mean, it's a heartbreaking, had a piece on Facebook and people can look it up, Dr. Brittany Cobia. It really is tragic and horrible. And it is fascinating to see this. And I would imagine it has to be, polling as well. And not even necessarily, I don't think they care about, frankly, I don't think it's that they're worried about their own voters in these states. You look at a place like South Dakota. It's fascinating. You see the same infection rates as you do in Vermont. And South Dakota has, it is speculated, more or less the same level of herd immunity to the extent that that exists, you know, when we talk about the Delta. Same amount of people that, you know, whereas Vermont has a very high vaccination rate, South Dakota has a very high rate of people who actually contracted COVID because of their big biker rally. And frankly, the way that Kristi Noem just basically decided, nah, I'm not going to worry about this. I'm not going to sweat it. But Vermont, and the same amount of infections, Vermont has literally 1/10 the number of deaths that South Dakota had.
I think it was like
200 in Vermont and 2,000 in South Dakota.
Oh my God.
And it's a fascinating comparison and contrast. And so I don't think it's that they're alarmed about their own people dying, frankly. If they were, then you'd see more Republicans expanding Medicaid. I think it's more that they are seeing polling that shows, my guess is, independents who are looking at the Republicans and again judging them on their response to COVID, just like they did Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And this new wave is shattering all of their talking points, because it is, I think it's also making people realize, like, we don't know that much about this. It is a novel coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And every time you have a variant, it's another novel coronavirus, not wholesale, but we don't know. We don't know questions about long haul with the Delta variant. We don't know. We don't think it is more virulent in terms of its ability to cause death, but we do know that it is much more transmissible. But we don't know if it's more deadly yet. We just simply don't have the data. And you know, they're doing a long form study on long haul for kids, which is under 12, which is obviously really important because they cannot get vaccinations. But this is something that we're going to be talking about, I think, in really stark terms over the next couple of weeks, because it's headed in a direction. It's not a good one.
I have to say, I'm having such a hard time. I'm trying to maintain my compassion here, really, and understanding that some people are just misinformed and other people just don't trust the government or don't trust the medical establishment or whatever, all of which is very understandable. But the political side of this,
yes,
the side of it that is just purely partisan nonsense, it's the same people who were storming state capitals, you know, over mask mandates. It's the same people who were staging stupid protests in front of grade schools right down the street from my house, saying that kids were being tortured by having to wear masks. This is the kind of craziness I'm really having a hard time continuing to be compassionate about. And you know, it's hard. They're making it very hard to continue to, you know, do whatever we can to try and help them understand and be persuasive. Right. And don't, you know, you had the National Review this week saying, you know, don't be harsh with these people.
Oh my God.
You know, be kind, and, you know, you don't humiliate them. And, you know, I get that. I understand that, the psychology of that. But honestly, it's getting a little old, because we've been in this thing now for a year and a half, and these people are not budging. And we have a free, readily accessible medical miracle that will save your life. It's out there. Mm-hmm. And honest to God, it's absolutely driving me crazy. It's testing my compassion.
I couldn't agree more. And I look at people like Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham. Look, I have a child under the age of 12, and you know, it is we cannot, you know, go out and essentially use the vaccine in the way that we want to, because we're still afraid of that child getting COVID. And, you know, 20% of the children who get COVID have long haul. This is according to Dr. Michael Osterholm, who I spoke to on the first hour of the Majority Report on Monday of this week. And, you know, that's a very scary thing. And so, you know, these people, they want to risk their own lives. I'm not, you know, I think at one point we need to have compulsory activity, you know, compulsory vaccination for certain activities. But they're also jeopardizing, you know, my child and other children who are not eligible for the vaccination. And of course, there's other members of our society who are not, you know, can't get vaccinated for whatever reason.
Right.
And so it really is distressing. All right. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about January 6th commission. And also, if we have time, Donald Trump's good buddy, turns out, who could have imagined, was lobbying for a foreign government without telling anybody about it. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. So, Heather, we were talking about the infrastructure bill, and we talked about the Delta variant of the coronavirus and what the implications that has had in terms of, like, you know, Republican politics. They seem to be trying to pivot and you know, I don't want to get bogged down again, but I think, like, you know, the Hannity thing is the sort of gives away the ghost. Like, they want it out there. They want to maintain their base, but they also want it out there and feed those independents and say, like, look, here's evidence that we did promote vaccinations, even though the main gist of what they're saying is to be skeptical.
Right.
The vaccinations, et cetera, et cetera.
And, do your and research.
Don't be forced. Don't be forced to do it. Take it, you know, just really missing the urgency of this. And then there's another development that's happening. And you and I think we're afraid that something like this would happen. Not so much about the January 6th participation by the Republicans. It's the way that it's being communicated to the American public. Well, lay this out for us, because, you know, people should remember the Democrats offered to have a completely bipartisan committee that was not even made up of members of sitting members, bipartisan in process in the way they developed it, and completely bipartisan in practice. I mean, so much so that I would have been like, I don't know if you should do that. But they did. They offered it. And then the Republicans walked away. And then why don't you pick up the narrative from there?
Well, the Republicans walked away, and remember that the Republicans walked away in the Senate. The House passed it with like 22 Republican votes. I mean, it was a Republican, it was a bipartisan vote to do that, as well as a bipartisan commission that they came up with. And it was eminently fair. It really was. I mean, this, they had tons of power, and I was skeptical of that. I thought, I don't know if that's such a good idea to give, you know, these Republicans and whoever's on this committee that kind of power. It seemed kind of crazy to me. But, you know, okay, they were trying to do that. They did it. They walked away. And then, you know, Pelosi, they were wondering if she would follow through, and she did, and rightfully so. They tried, they wanted to kill her that day. So she has kind of a personal stake in trying to get to the bottom of what happened here. And I think that it, and a stake for the country. So she put together this commission. It's got Liz Cheney. So there is one very right wing, super hawkish, you know, conservative on there. Ideologically, she holds down that side very well. Although she is not, you know, she is one who is, you know, not forgiving of Donald Trump and what happened that day. So then, you know, it's McCarthy, she gives McCarthy five slots on the committee, and he comes up with a group of screaming harpy, you know, anti-democratic, super Trump loving guys. Now, two of them were completely unacceptable. Out of that group, to me, they were all unacceptable. There were much better people they could have found across the board to put on to. He could have found that would be much more neutral, or just kind of, you know, backbencher types who nobody knows, you know, that didn't have an axe to grind. But he put people with axes to grind on there, people who had voted for to overturn the election, essentially. Yep. You know, Jim Jordan and
Jim Banks.
What's his name? Banks. Jim Banks, those two are hardcore pro-Trump warriors. And they made it very clear the minute they were named that they were just going to go in there and they were going to wreck the place. They were going to destroy that commission. I had that those committee hearings. And we've seen that before. This is nothing new. We've seen Jim Jordan in action. He certainly has. He did it in the impeachment hearings. He did it across the board. So Pelosi said no, which she had the right to do. And, you know, they had a right to a commission where she didn't have that power to remove anybody from the commission. But they passed on that. So in the new thing, she based it entirely on the Benghazi Select Committee. She used the Republican rules across the board for this one that they had used on the Benghazi Committee. So, you know, ostensibly, they shouldn't be able to gripe, but of course they do. So what happens? They do this. She kicks those two off. McCarthy comes back screaming and yelling. He's removing all of his people. And what does the press do? They frame this as Nancy Pelosi really screwed the pooch on this. And she made a big mistake and handed Kevin McCarthy a big victory. I say, what are you talking about? At every step of the way, the Republicans have claimed this was a partisan exercise, even when it was as bipartisan as you can get. They voted en masse against doing the bipartisan bill in the Senate. They've been screaming and yelling about partisanship from the very beginning. So in this case, she wants to have a series of hearings and an investigation that is not interrupted by two circus clowns screaming and yelling at the witnesses. And they're saying, oh, she really blew it by not letting them do that. This is, Josh Marshall often says this, he says this town, D.C., is wired for Republicans. And this shows that is still the case. You have these new groups like Punchbowl, you've got Political Playbook, you've got various, you know, Chris Cillizza on CNN, you've got some others who are just, they are reverting to form here.
Yep.
And this was not, I can't emphasize this enough, this was not a gift to Kevin McCarthy. It was just an acceptance of what Kevin McCarthy was going to do anyway. And Nancy Pelosi very wisely said, you know what, I'm not going to turn these hearings into a circus. We're not doing that this time. And as a result, yes, the press will present it as one-sided partisan, whatever, but at least they'll be able to have witnesses. We can share the clips all over the internet. Everyone can at least see without interruption from these, you know, these the hardcore Trump people who are very clearly, and this is the story, right? They're covering up what happened. There's no other way to, there's no other way to explain this. And the press is not covering it that way. Why wouldn't you look at this and go, what do the Republicans have to hide? Why? But they're not saying it.
The problem, it seems to me, and we just have about a minute or so left. The problem, it seems to me, has been in the past is that Democrats react to what that conventional beltway media presents. And if they don't react, I mean, certainly, like, you know, I don't know how many people listened to Chris Cillizza 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But whatever that number was, it's much less now. And I mean, honestly, like, it's just simply there's just too many alternative means in which people are getting their news, and they don't need it filtered by people like that. But the question is, does this change the Democratic behavior? And I think we're going to see, because if they just go full force with this committee, if you are right and there are some like things to find here, that's going to resonate regardless of who finds them with the American public. And it's not going to matter at that point. You know, this attempt to say that should have been bipartisan or whatnot, but that it's not bipartisan because of the Republicans. But Heather, we're going to have to pick up the ball on this next week. As always, a pleasure, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
The fish rots from the head down, as the phrase goes, and the American ruling class, as our next guest puts it, is rotting. A rot that specifically started in this iteration in the mid-20th century and gets worse to this day. Here to explain why that's the case is Doug Henwood, journalist, editor of Left Business Observer. He's a radio host and author of multiple books. His piece on this in Jacobin is entitled Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, in my estimation, under capitalism, the ruling class of every generation, and in feudalism and historically, the ruling class of every generation has a bit of a rotting effect during the Jim Crow era. You know, in the United States, the greed of railroad monopolists, right? Just to come up with some examples. But in many ways, I would say that's a function of our version of capitalism. What makes this rot more pungent and pervasive, shall we say?
Well, I would say that we had a much more coherent ruling class roughly from the end of the 19th century to maybe the 1970s. And there are the WASPs, based in the Northeast, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They married together. They came out of a pretty coherent social formation. They contrived the whole post-World War II order. They were really specialized in foreign policy, but they, you know, they staffed the Roosevelt administration, then had a lot to do with the New Deal, even the Eisenhower years, and then back into the 1960s with the Kennedy administration. They had many vices. They were awful racists and snobs, but there was ability to look beyond the next earnings report or the next election cycle and plan somewhat for the long term. I think now we have a group of people who are just driven by accumulating as much money as possible and no sense of anything outside the market, anything outside the pursuit of the dollar. And certainly that's been true for a lot of American history. This has been a money-obsessed culture. But there was a period, I think, where there was able to have a certain degree of long-term planning and thoughtfulness that just doesn't exist now. And so, for example, I think that if we had a more coherent ruling class, they would be able to think more clearly about the climate crisis and actually do something about it. It might not be what we would like. It might not, you know, it certainly would not be eco-socialism by any means, but it would actually, they would be able to process the problem and do something about it. And I just don't see that in this current gang. There's just too many, there's an ethic of pillage, I think, that really dominates a lot of their thinking.
Well, so then what incentives got us to this point? Because, I mean, I know you wrote a good amount about the rise of the private equity, of passive investments / income as a model for economic growth, and this shift kind of happening in the mid to late 20th century. Would that be the number one driver, would you say?
Well, there's several things going on. I think, first of all, the WASPs got tired as an elite. There's an Italian elite theorist who says, you know, history is the graveyard of aristocracies, and that, you know, they had really, their time had passed. There's this, you know, idea that, you know, the first generation makes the money, the second generation learns to be civilized, and the third generation just becomes, you know, a bunch of hippie artists and bohemians. And that's a caricature, but there's some truth to it. Their money got damaged by, you know, ruined by inflation. Their fortunes are eroded with inflation and inheritance. But they're also based in a lot of old line industries, particularly like manufacturing in the Northeast and banking in the Northeast. And with those industries really ran into trouble starting in the 1970s. And so the material basis of their wealth also eroded. And then beginning in the early 1980s, you saw the rise of this new class of a new set of robber barons driven by, you know, borrowed money and went wild in the financial markets, taking over companies, disrupting the entire corporate landscape, the economic landscape. And created fortunes of a sort we hadn't seen in close to a century. If you look back, the Forbes 400 list of the 400 richest people in the U.S. started in 1982, and there weren't that many billionaires. Certainly, you know, it's been inflation then, so a billion isn't what it used to be, but we just didn't have this class of billionaires that we do now. There's just an accumulation of wealth at the very top and, you know, centimillionaires. We haven't seen since the period between, say, 1870 and 1929. So the old order collapsed, and then they were replaced by this gang of new plutocrats with no sense of social responsibility, no sense of anything beyond making themselves as rich as possible. And, you know, that they haven't really established themselves as a more civilized formation. They're still largely, you know, brutal and greedy.
Well, so, I mean, two questions there. One, how much did that have to do with the modern Republican Party becoming what it is, right, with Nixon and Reagan, specifically Reagan, really. And two, I feel it's not a uniquely American phenomenon because, you know, colloquially we talk about the rise of neoliberalism. I mean, this seems to have been, and yes, it's mostly American, but it trickled down into politics internationally, this kind of obsession with markets and shareholders as primary in economic systems. Just talk about those two things.
Okay, I'll just start with the second one first, because I think we see something similar going on in Europe. And a very stark example of that is the way the European elites handled the euro crisis of, you know, like 10 years ago. I guess it's becoming a distant memory. But Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister and economist, told me once in an interview that the architects of the euro, the currency, in the early 1980s, had this idea that the thing was kind of crisis prone, that yoking all these different economies together under one currency would eventually provoke a crisis. And they thought, and he's talking about Mitterrand and Kohl, the leaders of France and Germany at the time, thought that the crisis would provoke a restructuring of the European system so that there'd be much more common governance, common fiscal policy, just a much more integration of the political side than occurred. But when the crisis hit, the mediocrities who were governing Europe at that point really had no sense of how to handle it. So it was just driven by German notions of austerity and harsh discipline. But they did not use the occasion of that crisis to create a new political order. Now, it might not be the political order we would have liked. Again, you know, it would have been probably a neoliberal political order. But they were unable to use that crisis to turn the European EU into something more coherent as a longer-term political project. So, yes, I think there are really analogs around the world. And, you know, looking like Brazil right now, Bolsonaro.
God. Yeah.
I mean, that's just, you know, a hellhole. I mean, it's just insane. And a lot of that is a result of erosion of any kind of ruling class in Brazil and institutions associated with ruling classes. So, yes, it is a worldwide phenomenon. I live here, so I'm most aware of what's going on here. And we also have been, you know, the most important bourgeoisie in the world, as the folks at Workers' Vanguard used to say, the president of the United States is the chief executive of the world bourgeoisie. And, you know, that's still, despite the erosion of U.S. power and prestige, is still sort of true. But yeah, the Republican Party is a very important part of this story. You know, if you go back into the, say, the 50s, the Eisenhower era, they had made peace with the New Deal. And they didn't necessarily want to expand it, but they also didn't want to destroy it. Eisenhower wrote in a famous letter to his brother that anybody who wanted to do away with labor laws and Social Security would be politically destroyed. And of course, there are some, he mentioned like Texas oil men. He said, there are some people like that, but their numbers are few and they are stupid. And those people eventually, they hated Eisenhower, those stupid and few in number of people hated Eisenhower, and they really organized to transform the Republican Party. And they saw it as a project of decades, and they were very successful. They turned it into an extreme right-wing formation and purged all those kind of moderates and even liberals from the Republican Party.
Well, fast forward, I don't mean to interrupt, but fast forward to the Obama presidency, where he was toying with the idea of cutting many of these New Deal programs, at least, you know, in his own centrist center left way, and appeasing Republicans in this area.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he and Biden too, they have this idea of preemptive compromise. Like, bipartisanship is almost some sort of virtue in itself, rather than just a way of coping with a divided, you know, polity. They just think that, oh, bipartisanship is so beautiful. And, you know, then you've got Mitch McConnell on the other side, who's just nothing but ruthless. And a Republican Party that, you know, is crazy in a lot of ways, but they do have a set of principles which they're fervently devoted to. And it's very hard to say the same about the Democratic Party. Obama, what was it, 3 months after taking office, he was on the phone with David Brooks saying that once they got out of the recession, they wanted to cut Social Security and Medicare. they're certainly not innocent. And I think that reflects, the growing influence of financiers of the Democratic Party, that the same kind of consciousness, which the Republicans have to an extreme, certainly has a large presence within the Democratic Party. Although I would say that the Democrats are more like Goldman Sachs types, like more respectable, more institutional, whereas a lot of the Republican financiers are hedge fund guys and private equity guys who imagine themselves, independent entrepreneurs and cowboys. There was that transformation of the Republican Party, and they became to reflect that starting in the 80s, this new class of plutocrats and cowboys who were just rampaging across the landscape, loading things up with debt, taking out money and stuffing it into their pockets. And that really became more and more the ethic of how American business worked, which was just get the profits up no matter what the cost, the social or environmental cost. And that's, somebody else's problem to clean up the mess.
Well, I mean, it brought the country into a recession in the early 1990s, which I want to ask you a little bit about, just to have more of a perspective on how we got to this point. After we take a quick break, we'll be right back. So before we broke, we were just kind of talking about how we got to this point where the ruling class is a rot that is just continuing to spread, and there are maggots, and it's just so unpleasant to behold, and has a real chilling effect or rotting effect, truly. On American life and on people who are not even in their social circles, given the fact that they are the ruling class. So we talked a little bit about Reagan. Actually, I want to touch more on that before we move into the 1990s. What did Reagan's politics do as one of the most transformative politicians of the past century? For worse. Yes. What did
there's no better.
There's no, I was going to say for better, for no, for worse, certainly. Yeah. What did that do to this kind of cascading rot that you talk about in your piece?
Well, he promoted it. He accelerated it by deregulating everything. And I must say, to be fair, the deregulations of a lot of things started under Carter. It wasn't just a Republican project. Teddy Kennedy really pushed transport deregulation, which decimated the Teamsters Union and the airline unions, and was very bad for labor, despite Teddy Kennedy's reputation as, the friend of labor, the great liberal. But yeah, I think Reagan accelerated that considerably and gave just ruthless financiers the upper hand in how to run the economy. And the stock market became the ultimate judge of whether economic policies were good or bad. If something added to the stock price, well, that was good. And that became the world we've known now for the last 40 years, which is just driven by stock prices and financial values. And then also by cutting taxes at the top, Reagan encouraged the creation of these new fortunes. If you before 1982, as I was saying about the Forbes 400 list, there just weren't these giant fortunes of this on the order of billions. They just did not exist. And part of the reason was the tax rate was high enough that was impossible to accumulate that kind of money. Once the taxes were cut, it became, and then of course the regulations and all and the politics then facilitated it, but it made it possible to accumulate gigantic fortunes in ways that we hadn't seen since the 1890s or 1920s. They really accelerated that. And they also spread the ethic of selfishness, of greed. Greed is good, as the Gordon Gekko movie said. That all just became common sense. And one of the ways in which Reagan was transformative is that he really did change, and this is drawing on Stuart Hall's work about Thatcherism, the common sense of the way people think about their lives. It all became about self-reliance, that any kind of politics or solidarity or collective action became discredited. And it was all about just your individual effort. And I think a whole generation, or maybe two, grew up with that as the norm, that there's nothing you can rely on except yourself. No union, no political formation. The whole notion of solidarity became really deeply discredited. And it was all about self-reliance. And again, self-reliance has a long history in American culture, but it just got amped up to a degree that we hadn't seen in a really, really long time.
Right. And we're seeing still many of this kind of colloquially PTSD that Democrats have about Reagan. I mean, the obsession that Nancy Pelosi has with pay-fors and pay-go and, you know, just this.
Well, Reagan didn't always worry about paying for things because he was happy to cut taxes.
He did not. But the messaging was exactly what I think older Democrats in leadership internalized, because they were so shell-shocked with these massive losses where Reagan created a whole new coalition of people as unions were on the decline, which I'm glad you mentioned, because I think that's so integral to the story. Then we move to the 1990s, where Bill Clinton embraced a lot of these politics. I mean, talk about his role in this this rot just accelerating.
Yeah, I mean, he really consolidated the victories of the Reagan Revolution. You know, there's that interim caretaker George H.W. Term, but no, Clinton was a significant figure, very talented politician, very influential in his way. But he really transformed the Democratic Party. And sometimes it's said that one of Thatcher's lasting achievements in Britain was the transformation of the Labour Party. I think you could say the same about Reagan, leading to a transformation of the Democratic Party. It became an entirely derivative formation. They just were like, yeah, okay, maybe a little softer, but you know, still, they were like Republican light at that point. And maybe the Democratic Party is changing now some. There's certainly a lot of progressive forces within it now that didn't.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Labor, because Corbyn and Bernie Sanders kind of coming onto the scene as dual voices that were trying to change the left parties in their country.
Yeah, and certainly the British establishment, the Labour establishment, destroyed Corbyn in the same way that the Democrats destroyed Sanders. You know, it's really amazing that that a lot of Democrats, mainstream Democrats, leading Democrats, are incapable of fighting Republicans very effectively, but they sure know how to police the left wing of their party.
Oh, yes. They have a lot of energy to censor Ilhan Omar for statements that they have arbitrarily decided, or really based on her race and ethnicity and religion, that are anti-Semitic, when, of course, we hear very little about, you know, what the right wing is doing.
Yeah, it's they're very selective in their outrage. But it's also it shows that they have the skills to organize if they want to, but it's only against a progressive target.
Right. And I think a lot of that has to do with kind of our next step in the rot of the ruling class and of our democracy or our republic or whatever you want to call it, which is campaign contributions, a.k.a. bribery in this country. Something like, you know, you talk about the Koch network in your piece. Just talk about that a little bit more, how that burgeoning industry of corruption and behemoths like the Koch network, and to a lesser extent, the Mercers who were behind Ted Cruz and then they were behind Donald Trump in the general in 2016, they jumped ship. You know, what that has done to accelerate the rot.
Well, yeah, the Kochs are very impressive in a lot of ways. Charles, his brother David is dead, but he was never really the brains of the operation. It was always Charles. But a friend of mine who met Charles Koch in the mid-1970s says this is a project of 40 years. And here we are, 40 plus years later, and you know, Charles Koch is still at it. But they did really accomplish an awful lot. And it wasn't just him, but he was really the leader of a group of like-minded plutocrats. They have their annual meetings, you know, they raise money, they decide what they're going to do with it. And interestingly, they do it in much more disciplined fashion than their democratic liberal counterparts. So there was a democracy alliance that was founded, I can't remember, maybe 10 years ago, that was meant to respond in a kind of progressive fashion to the Kochs. But it's all like, oh, just do your own thing, you know, contribute as you like. They get together to have meetings, but they don't have that same focus that Koch does, and Koch and his pals. And if you look at what they did, it's just extraordinarily impressive, creating all these think tanks. There's at least one Koch-financed think tank in every state in the country. Some states have two, or I think even one might even have three. They write bills for state legislatures, which get passed pretty much intact. They sponsor candidates, but they've also got think tanks. They've got university departments, endowed chairs. They take academia very seriously. They have this idea about the production of ideas, that you have an elite, an intellectual elite that comes up with the ideas. Then you have the think tank layer that spreads them around. And then the politicians then enact them. So they do have this. This is the organized part of the ruling class. And they are, but it's the far right. I mean, it's just, they're organized to destroy the state's more positive actions. The state to them is just a punitive assistant to accumulation. Any kind of good things the state might do, like redistribute income or regulate business or do something for the climate, you know, they're not into that at all. But they really know how to use politics to push their narrow ends. And there's just nothing on the center left that really compares to that. It's just
It should have been unions. It should have been unions. Instead, it's kind of been replaced by this amorphous coastal philanthropy wing.
Oh yeah,
which is a part of the rod in and of itself, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, philanthropists just exasperate me no end. they really.
It's not a popular thing to say, but I mean,
no, it's not. But you know, a lot of people want grants from them, so they don't want to offend them. But I don't want a grant from the Ford Foundation, and they're not likely to give me one.
You don't want any Bloomberg money?
No.
Quiet.
You know, if you look back at the history of the Ford Foundation, for example, it's pretty nasty. From organizing the coup, helping organize the coup in Indonesia to, really damaging the public education in the country. And now they're all about inequality. They're going to fix inequality with their giant fortune. There is that very narrow philanthropic focus, liberal foundations like Ford and Carnegie. And then, of course, there are new fortunes that we don't know how they're going to work out. But, you know, the Gates family, you know, certainly more the now cast broken asunder Gates family. And then Mackenzie Scott, giving away a lot of money in kind of interesting ways. So I don't know what she's up to, but you know, there's just nothing to counter the focus and power of the Kochs. And the labor movement, it's just, you know, American labor law is awful. It makes it really difficult to organize and sustain a union. There's just no question about it. But on the other hand, the leadership of the American labor movement is also just timid and a weak junior partner to the leadership of the Democratic Party. They just act as an ATM for the Democrats and really don't get much of anything in return. So you have a Republican Party that wants to destroy the labor movement completely. And you have a Democratic Party that doesn't really do anything to promote it. It's not out to destroy it actively because they're too valuable as campaign workers and financers, but they're just not going to do anything to promote the organization of the American workforce.
Right. And one of the grossest things to me is how the grassroots clearly wants Medicare for all. And sometimes, you know, old school union organizers, they use their health care plans as a way to recruit members. And so they're kind of, you know, fear mongering about a single payer health care system in tandem with the establishment of the Democratic Party.
Well, we have in New York State, you know, we have this attempt to create a Medicare for all just at the state level, the New York Health Act. And a lot of the state unions are opposed to it, because it's going to take away a selling point. So, you know, they don't have any sense of their duty to represent the working class as a whole. They're very narrow, self-interested organizations, you know, kind of guilty of what the Soviets used to call group narcissism, in a way that very reminiscent of the way the ruling class is and the business class is.
Well, they became establishments in and of themselves, right? And when you become that, when you become entrenched, it creates this dynamic. We just have a few moments left, so I just wanted to bring it home a bit. Where do you see this going if the rot continues?
Well, I think, you know, the climate crisis is so dire that we really need to do something very quickly and very seriously about it. And I just don't see that happening. When Biden first took office, I thought for a moment that And I do want to emphasize the fact that the political class really often organizes the moneyed. The people with the money don't always think about what policy or politics. They need to be told what to do. And they need a political class that organizes them in that sense. So for a moment, I thought that Biden might organize a certain wing of the liberal Wall Street into some kind of climate consciousness. And one of his advisors, Brian Deese, came out of BlackRock, the giant asset manager. And he was handling a lot of the climate stuff for BlackRock and thought, oh, yeah, maybe we'll get at least something half decent out of this. And, you know, it's falling apart. Like, it's just not happening. And there's just not that kind of organization that is really appropriate to the scale of the crisis that we're facing. So, you know, I think life itself, life on Earth is at risk precisely because of this disorganization and greed and selfishness and myopia of the American ruling class.
Well, on that incredibly uplifting note, no, I appreciate we must say goodbye.
Bring Doug, me back and I'll say something more uplifting.
Well, I mean, your reaction is appropriate and I share it. So Doug Henwood, excuse me, journalist, editor of Left Business Observer. He's a radio host. You can read his books and his piece in Jacobin on what we discussed here, which is very extensive. Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class. Thank you so much, Doug, for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio, but you can keep up with us throughout the week online at ringoffireradio.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio, and you can find us on Facebook. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream or later as a podcast. We cover all the biggest news stories of the day, and we do in-depth interviews. It's with me and Emma Vigilant. So check it out. And for Emma Vigilant and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.